Coming up is the news.
U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden says he's going to win the race for the White House. He's expanding his lead over President Trump in key states. Several prominent U.S. Republicans back President Trump's claims of election fraud, while some others distance themselves from his stance. Iran announces new restrictions for businesses as part of efforts to tackle the growing number of COVID-19 cases and deaths. Good to have you with us. Starting with U.S. election news, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has once again addressed the nation while his lead is growing in several battleground states in the race for the White House.
We're going to win this race. Just look at what has happened since yesterday. 24 hours, we were behind in Georgia. Now we're ahead, and we're going to win that state. 24 hours ago, we're behind in Pennsylvania, and we are going to win Pennsylvania. And now we're ahead, but we're winning in Arizona, winning in Nevada. In fact, our lead just doubled in Nevada.
Biden urged American people to be patient and wait for all the ballots to be counted. He stressed the purpose of American politics should be solving problems, not fanning the flames of conflict. The former vice president was speaking from his hometown state of Delaware. This is while the campaign of incumbent President Donald Trump has filed lawsuits to challenge the vote counts and results in several states. Trump supporters have also held rallies outside ballot counting centers in different cities, demanding a recount. Protesters stress Trump's allegation that Democrats have rigged the vote. In Arizona, some of the Trump supporters were seen carrying firearms. In Pennsylvania, the demonstrators called for the disqualification of delayed mail-in ballots, but the state's apex court rejected their claims. Trump himself has vowed to continue the fighting, saying that he has no plans to concede. Tensions growing as the vote counting is ongoing in several swing states where a record number of people cast their ballots by mail. While the votes are still being counted, the U.S. is also increasingly scrutinized for legitimacy. The country's perpetually high voter abstention rates have also generated regular doubts about a level of domestic approval of their political process. Rami Mazzari has more from Chicago.
The United States presidential vote continues to be tabulated amid claims of fraud and a lack of transparency. Challenger Joe Biden appears to have a small lead, but a final vote tally seems days away to many. After that, long and torturous court battles could ensue, creating more animosity in an already deeply divided nation.
In a bit of good news, voter turnout is projected to be the highest since the year 1900. In bad news, it's only going to be about 65%, which would still be just below the average rate among developed countries.
Since the 1970s, voter turnout has averaged just 54%. By comparison, since 1997, Iran's presidential turnout rate has been 74%. The low turnout is attributed to a massive alienation from the political process among America's poor and minority classes.
Democrat, Republican, conservative is like voting for Lucifer, Satan, and the devil. You'll catch hell with all three. Politically, it's not going to make any difference. I vote. I've always voted. But if you ask me if I really believe that Democrats, if they get in charge, the reality of what happens to poor people and black people in this country, if there's going to be some major change, my answer to that is absolutely not.
Analysts say that if the 2020 presidential election is not decided fairly and transparently, it could drop voter turnout for a generation. Minorities pinned major hopes on Donald Trump's predecessor, but his perceived failures has disillusioned many, and younger voters especially.
Democrats have been in charge and things have not gotten any better. When President Barack Obama was president of the United States, nothing changed for black people. So why would I somehow believe that President Joe Biden is somehow going to change what is systemically wrong in this country?
America's Latino population is now almost 50% higher than the African-American population. Yet Latino voter turnout is a whopping 40% lower than the combined rate of whites and blacks. Latinos often decry how they are virtually invisible in American culture and how they hold very few positions of political power, fueling abstention. The unprecedented turnout of 2020 is being attributed to the controversial use of mail-in ballots, whose legitimacy will seemingly be publicly decided by the time this election is over. Perhaps mail-in ballots increase opportunities for fraud, but perhaps they are a valid tool which can be used to help solve the perpetually high abstention rates in the United States. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Now, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives has called Democratic President candidate Joe Biden president-elect, even though the vote count against some battleground states continues.
President-elect Biden has a strong mandate to lead, and he'll have a strong Democratic House with him and many Democrats in the Senate.
A top Democrat, Nancy Pelosi, says it's clear that Biden will be the next president of the United States, hailing him as a unifier. She also referred to current President Donald Trump as a lame duck. Pelosi warned, however, that Trump will try to destroy the credibility of the election and do mischief as long as he remains in office. Now, in the meantime, several prominent Republicans have rallied behind President Donald Trump over his claims that Democrats are using illegal votes in an attempt to steal the election.
I think you're going to see in the next 48 hours real evidence of systematic voting irregularities. There's a complaint filed by the U.S. Attorney to the U.S. Attorney in Michigan of someone, I think, in the post office who was told to backdate ballots instead of November the 4th. It'd be November the 3rd, so they'd be counted. Democracy.
Graham described the results in Philadelphia as crooked as a snake. Representative Kevin McCarthy, who leads the Republican minority in the House, says that the results are far from over. Senator Ted Cruz claims that Pennsylvania's Democratic Attorney General has ordered vote counting in Philadelphia to continue until Joe Biden wins. However, other Republicans distanced themselves from Trump's claims of fraud or adopted a more balanced stance. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says every legal vote should be counted, while illegally submitted ballots must not. Trump campaign has filed lawsuits in several states, reaching out to donors to raise at least $60 million to fund legal challenges. A journalist and political commentator, Richard Silverstein, says if elected to the White House, Joe Biden is likely to be what America needs in the long run.
Well, I think that Biden is a moderate, he's a pragmatic person, he's a calming influence. I don't think that he is a visionary. I don't think that he's got a lot of charisma. I think that he's someone who's going to try to devise a program and execute it and appoint talented and competent people to implement the program. I think that he is right now probably what America needs. I don't think that in the long run he is what America needs, but at this moment in time where we have a corrupt, corrosive, toxic atmosphere with tons of violence and threats of potential terrorist attacks from white supremacists who reject this outcome, I think that we need a calm, healing voice at this time to combat the poison that Trump is injecting.
The More Comments political commentator Margaret Kimmerle says the desire to get President Donald Trump out of office is the main reason for the huge turnout in the U.S. presidential election.
What is surprising is the fact that it's taken, this is now the third day of counting votes, but that's an indication of the huge turnout that was created, frankly, by Donald Trump and by the desire to get this man out of office so that many of those who sat out in 2016 were moved to get to the polls in 2020. But it's interesting, Biden appears to be headed to victory. It's much more difficult for Donald Trump to get there. And that is why he is calling these lawsuits, which I believe will be futile. We're going to have a Biden presidency, but that brings with it some challenges because there's a large number of voters who just want to get rid of Trump, who have not really asked much of Biden. And he is in a position, frankly, to create huge problems in this country and around the world.
In other news, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says that Iran only values actions, not words, when it comes to dealings with the United States. Speaking to Latin American television network Telesur, Zarif said that there are obvious differences between President Donald Trump and his rival Joe Biden. However, he said that what's important for Iran is not the tone or the rhetoric, but the actions. Biden has promised to return to a 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and the world powers if elected president. Trump walked away from the accord in 2018, imposing tough sanctions on Iran. Zarif says that the U.S. has to gain a seat at the negotiating table if it wants to return to the deal. The top diplomat also noted that Washington needs to change its practice for the situation to change. Now, that's while the pandemic continues to rage across Europe, several countries on that continent reporting a new record high in their daily infections. Ukraine has reported more than 10,500 new cases, the highest single-day increase there so far. Russia registered over 20,000 new cases and 364 related deaths in one day. In Germany, data from the Robert Koch Institute show over 23,000 more people contracted disease, pushing the national tally to 642,000. Europe is currently the hardest hit zone in the world, with more than 12 million cases. A steep rise in infections has prompted many countries to impose stricter measures to contain the virus across the continent. Now, protest rallies against the government's handling of the pandemic crisis have continued in Italy. Anger taxi drivers set the stage two rallies in Rome, urging executives to support their sector with subsidies. Max Chivity has more from Rome.
On Friday, taxi drivers went on a one-day strike nationwide, calling the government's attention to the economic plight they're facing following the pandemic crisis and the connected restrictions. Unions also called two protests held in front of the economy and transport ministries, attended by thousands of taxi drivers from across the country. Drivers are demanding more support from the government as, quote, they don't have the money to pay the monthly costs of the vehicles, nor to provide for their families.
Gli aiuti ricevuti sono assolutamente insufficienti.
The subsidies we have received from the government so far are totally inadequate. €275 each month is not sufficient. How are we supposed to put food on the table for our families? Consider we have suffered losses in the range of 80 to 90%.
Intorno ai €3,600.
Io ho ricevuto.
My income has dropped by 80%, but all expenses have remained unvaried. Insurance fees, fuel and car disinfection costs have not been reduced. Furthermore, the government is doing nothing to stop illegal cabs from going around.
È molto alta.
A new three-tier restriction system came into force on Friday. As a result, four Italian regions, namely Calabria, Lombardy, Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, have been placed in soft lockdowns. The government has also imposed a nationwide curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m., requiring all museums and galleries to shut down and all shopping centers to close on weekends.
Protests against the new anti-COVID restrictions imposed by the government have been staged in a number of cities across Italy. Some demonstrations turned violent as protesters vented their frustration and anger over how the pandemic crisis has been handled.
The virus is a moving train. Today it is necessary to slow it down, otherwise the train will knock us down. We are hopeful that these measures will be limited to several weeks.
The new restrictions imposed by the Italian government apply for about 4 weeks until December 3. Max Civili, Rome.
The British government's role in propping up Bahrain regime is common knowledge, but names are now surfacing. Reports saying that influential British figures have been advising King Hamad in order to solidify their strategic alliance. Bianca Rahimi has a report.
On the 14th of March 2011, Bahraini security forces began a violent crackdown on protests demanding greater political participation, free and fair elections, and an end to corruption and equality for the country's suppressed Shia majority. It has now been revealed that the UK's top military officer, General Sir David Richards, was in Manama holding meetings with the country's senior military officials and the Crown Prince 5 days earlier. In the brutal crackdown, Bahrain security forces were backed by 1,000 UK-trained and equipped Saudi troops. Since then, almost all prominent human rights defenders and dissidents have been jailed, silenced, or forced into permanent exile. The main opposition party, Al-Wefaq, has been dissolved, and the country's only independent newspaper, Al-Wasat, forcibly closed down. Torture is widespread in Bahrain's prisons, especially for the purpose of extracting confessions that are used to sentence people to death. And the country has the largest number of political prisoners in relation to population.
We have interviewed people, men, women and children, who have been tortured by the regime. Children who have been snatched from the streets by armed gangs and have been then beaten and driven around the streets. One boy had his teeth knocked in, and they are forced then to inform on family members or friends or people that they know in the villages who have attended democratic protests or have attended political gatherings. Inside the prisons, people have been waterboarded. They've been beaten with truncheons on their bare bodies and on their feet. They've been hung for hours, days, and deprived of sleep. They have been anally raped with truncheons. They have been just the cruelest, most inhumane treatment.
Nonetheless, the British government continues to support the regime. When construction began on a new permanent naval base in Bahrain in 2015, then UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said this.
This will give us the flexibility to respond to any emerging challenge in the Gulf, whether it's from a state actor or a non-state actor, whether it's from within the Gulf or outside the Gulf. This enhances our range. It gives Britain a permanent naval base east of Suez for the first time since 1967.
Strategic interests seem to be Westminster's priority. According to Human Rights Watch, arbitrary arrests, torture, executions and forced disappearances continue with very little interference from so-called democracies. Bianca Rahimi, Press TV, London.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you
every single moment. In the limelight. Nearly a year into the global coronavirus pandemic, scientists, doctors, and patients are beginning to unlock a puzzling phenomena. For many patients, including young ones, who never required hospitalization, COVID-19 has a devastating second act. Many are dealing with symptoms weeks or even months after they were expected to recover, often with puzzling new complications that can affect the entire body. Complications such as severe fatigue, cognitive issues and memory lapses, digestive problems, erratic heart rates, headaches, dizziness, fluctuating blood pressure, and even hair loss. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Wall Street Journal journalists Sarah Toy, Samathi Reddy, and Daniela Hernandez. The piece is titled, Doctors Begin to Crack COVID's Mysterious Long-Term Effects. Stay with us for more of Sarah Toy, Samathi Reddy, and Daniela Hernandez's article. Nearly a year into the global coronavirus pandemic, scientists, doctors, and patients are beginning to unlock a puzzling phenomena. For many patients, including young ones who never required hospitalization, COVID-19 has a devastating second act. Many are dealing with symptoms weeks or even months after they were expected to recover, often with puzzling new complications that can affect the entire body. Complications such as severe fatigue, cognitive issues and memory lapses, digestive problems, erratic heartbeat, headaches, dizziness, fluctuating blood pressure, and even hair loss. What is surprising to doctors is that many such cases involve people whose original cases weren't the most serious, undermining the assumption that patients with mild COVID-19 recover within 2 weeks. Doctors call the condition post-acute COVID or chronic COVID, and sufferers often refer to themselves as long haulers or long COVID patients. Usually, the patients with bad disease are most likely to have persistent symptoms, but COVID doesn't work like that, said Tricia Greenhalgh, professor of primary care at University of Oxford in England and the lead author of an August BMJ study that was among the first to define chronic COVID patients as those with symptoms lasting more than 12 weeks and spanning multiple organ systems. For many such patients, Greenhalgh says, the disease itself is not that bad, but symptoms like memory lapses and rapid heart rate sometimes persist for months. In October, the National Institutes of Health added a description of such cases to its COVID-19 treatment guidelines, saying doctors were reporting COVID-19-related long-term symptoms and disabilities in people with milder illness. You don't realize how lucky you are with your health until you don't have it, said Elizabeth Moore, a 43-year-old lawyer and mother of three in Valparaiso, Indiana. Pre-COVID-19, she was an avid skier and did workouts several times a week. Since falling ill in March, she has been struggling with symptoms including memory problems and gastrointestinal issues. She has lost nearly 30 pounds in weight. estimates about the percentage of COVID-19 patients who experience long-haul symptoms range widely. A recent survey of more than 4,000 COVID-19 patients found that about 10% of those aged between 18 and 49 still struggled with symptoms 4 weeks after becoming sick. That 4.5% of all ages had symptoms for more than 8 weeks, and 2.3% had symptoms for more than 12 weeks. The study, which hasn't yet been peer-reviewed, was performed using an app created by the health science company Zoe in cooperation with King's College, University of London and Massachusetts General Hospital. Another preliminary study looking mostly at non-hospitalized COVID patients found that about 25% still had at least one symptom after 90 days. A European study found about one-third of 1,837 non-hospitalized patients reported being dependent on a caregiver about 3 months after symptoms started. With more than 46 million cases worldwide, even the lower estimates would translate into millions of people living with long-term, sometimes disabling conditions, increasing the urgency to study this patient population, researchers said. What they find could have implications for how clinicians define recovery and what therapies they prescribe, doctors said. Doctors say anxiety caused by social isolation and uncertainty surrounding the pandemic may exacerbate symptoms, though that isn't likely the primary cause. Other viral outbreaks, including the original SARS, MERS, Ebola, H1N1, and the Spanish flu, have been associated with long-term symptoms. Scientists reported that some patients experience fatigue, sleep problems, and joint and muscle pain long after their bodies clear the virus, according to a recent review chronicling the long-term effects of viral infections. What differentiates COVID-19 is the far-reaching nature of its effects. Whilst it starts in the lungs, it often affects many other parts of the body, including the heart, the kidneys, and the digestive and nervous systems, according to doctors. I haven't really seen any other illness that affects so many different organ systems in as many different ways as COVID does, said Zijian Chen, a medical doctor from Mount Sinai Health System Center for Post-COVID Care. He described colleagues who were energetic, but after getting sick, had trouble getting through the day. He said he has seen up close how COVID-19 still affects their ability to do the things that they love. We thought it was a virus that once it does what it does, you recover and you go back to normal, he said. Sometimes that isn't the case, and that is really scary, he said. A leading explanation for long COVID symptoms is that immune system activity and ensuing inflammation continue to affect organs or the nervous system even after the virus is gone, according to researchers. Some of the most compelling evidence for the inflammation theory comes from COVID-19 patients with signs of heart inflammation and injury months after the illness. One study looking at 100 COVID-19 patients 2 months after getting sick found that 78 had abnormal findings on cardiac magnetic resonance imaging, while 60 had cardiac magnetic resonance imaging indicating heart muscle inflammation. The study included hospitalized, non-hospitalized, and asymptomatic patients. Even those who had no symptoms at all and were young and fit, even in those patients we saw abnormalities, said Ike Nagel, one of the lead authors and director of the Institute for Experimental and Translational Cardiovascular Imaging at the University Hospital Frankfurt in Germany. Some patients had scarring on their heart imaging, he said, which worried him. The scarring wasn't too serious, he said, but we know from other studies that this is related to worse outcomes. Doctors also reporting cases of long COVID patients with gastrointestinal issues, Recent work has found a new coronavirus known as SARS-CoV-2 in fecal matter and intestinal lining of some COVID-19 patients, suggesting the virus can infect and damage the cells of the gut. The intestines have a high density of ACE2 receptors, a type of protein on the surface of cells which SARS-CoV-2 uses to infiltrate cells.
Welcome to The Debate, and my name is Gisum Shahmadi. U.S. Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden has reached what appears to be a crucial point in the race to the White House, taking the lead in key states where vote counting is still underway and postal ballots are tipping the scales in the Democrats' favor. However, a smooth transfer of power still seems far from certain, as the White House put out a statement insisting that this election is not over. Donald Trump and a handful of his loyalists continue to allege election fraud. In this edition of the debate, we will be taking a closer look at how deeply polarized society is bringing chaos to a country that used to put itself forward as a beacon of democracy and criticize countries where election results were challenged.
The U.S. presidential vote remained unclear days after polls ended. The Democratic challenger, Joe Biden, appears to have a slight lead over the incumbent, Donald Trump. But analysts say that Trumpism overwhelmingly beat back the mainstream media's widely predicted blue wave, as conservatives maintained or increased their overall control at almost every other level of national and state government. Both candidates are being widely criticized for making statements regarding the outcome of the vote before all the votes are counted in this highly charged election. It has been seen in countless elections worldwide that any candidate who declares early is risking deadly violence for personal gain. It creates confusion, anger, and undermines the entire election process.
And just even using it as an excuse to riot and, just act crazy and stuff, but definitely all the divisiveness needs to stop, and I could see a lot of violence happening, but at the same time, I think also just the media is kind of exaggerating things and acting like some crazy stuff's going to happen, but really, who knows, you know what I mean? I think most people are pretty level-headed.
Prematurely declaring victory is also rather useless in highly decentralized American democracy, which does have checks and balances to executive orders. And while there have been many presidential assassinations, there have never been any open coups to take over the executive branch.
And it just drags everyone else down, unfortunately, because when this is resolved, we're still divided. There will be no coming together like there was with Bush v. Gore, or even like there was last time with, even though we still were very divided in 2016, there was still some resolution on the half of the American country.
The early declarations are not unexpected. For months, both candidates have sown doubts about the legitimacy of the election, with Trump asserting that this was the most fraudulent vote in the nation's history, while Biden repeatedly warned that Trump was attempting to steal the election. America is still counting the presidential votes, but the damage this election has wrought on the national culture appears to be immense. With both candidates flouting the necessary rules of comportment for months, the U.S. presidency may never be looked at the same again. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Now to continue our discussion, we're joined by Anthony Brian Logan, conservative political commentator, and also Robert Petillo, Democratic strategist, joining us live right now. Let's begin with Mr. Logan. According to Fox News, Donald Trump does not have plans to immediately concede the election. Is it legally necessary for him to do so, and what does it mean if he doesn't?
No, I don't think so. I don't know about a law that says you must concede after an election. I think the main thing is looking at everything legally. Do some vote recounting if necessary. Look at some of the claims of voter fraud, votes that were found in the garbage, set on fire. Look at the things that have happened. You know, investigate all the claims. Approach it from a legal point of view, and then we get to the actual conclusion.
Thank you very much, Jeanette. And let's bring in Mr. Patel. What is your opinion? Do you think it's legally necessary for Donald Trump to concede?
It's not absolutely not legally necessary at all. It's a gentlemanly thing to do with respect to the office, understanding the importance of the peaceful transition of power being a hallmark of our democracy. Going back to Marbury versus Madison, what our nation has prided itself on is the peaceful transfer of power. And when we have not done that, we've seen the nation still come together thereafter. We saw in 2000 with Bush v. Gore, the nation recovered from that. We saw from the Nixon impeachment the near impeachment of Nixon after Watergate, the nation still came together. So this will be a blip on the radar. I think what we do need to do is continue counting the votes and counting the ballots, ensuring that the Constitution is respected, and more so understanding that President Trump lost the election by 4 million votes in the popular vote after losing the last election by 3 million votes in the popular vote. So in two elections, we have 7 million people voting against this president, but they're still attempting to glom onto power and make it seem as though this is being taken from them. The democratic system will prevail. Our nation is stronger than any one man or any other individual. This is why it's the office of the presidency, and we do not pray to or worship the president himself.
Thank you very much. Let's go back to Mr. Logan. The shadow of a legal battle is hanging over the U.S. elections. How far do you think this can go?
It'll probably go all the way to the Supreme Court. And I think that a lot of us saw this coming before the actual election happened, because right when they said, okay, we're going to have maybe universal mail-in ballots, that opens the door right there for voter fraud. And then also you have some states where you don't have voter ID required. There's plenty of open space and gaps for fraud to happen. So I think that a lot of us saw this whole fight coming. And then as far as there being a big gap in the number of votes, of course, I mean, that may happen. You may lose the popular vote, and that's okay. But the main thing is being able to talk to everyone across the United States. So individual states that have small populations don't get overlooked. And it's not just about the states. It's about individual people as well. We want to have all the votes counted. We want to make sure we don't have dead people voting. We want to make sure that those that are registered to vote are actually voting, and it's themselves voting and not someone else. No identity theft. So as soon as we get through all of the claims and all of the possible illegalities, then we'll be able to see what's really going on here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. Now, Mr. Petillo, when do you think the Supreme Court can step in, and will the U.S. House be able to step in according to U.S. law?
The United States House is not stepping in. The Supreme Court is not stepping in. Frankly, most of these lawsuits have already been dismissed. We had a case in Savannah, Georgia that was dismissed by Judge Bass down there. And we've had the case in Philadelphia has already been thrown out. But when Republicans talk about this voter fraud, it's a completely made-up thing because they can't point to any instance of it happening. Even when we were fighting against voter ID laws 20 years ago, they never presented any evidence of in-person voter fraud. And the compromise coming out of that was to do mail-in ballots with a paper trail to ensure that there was no voter fraud, and now they're claiming that mail-in ballots are voter fraud also. Understand, Republicans have lost the popular vote in every election except for one since 1990. In eight of the last nine presidential elections, Republicans have failed to garner the popular vote. They are a dying party with a dying ideology. So what do you do when you are a dying party with a dying ideology that does not comport with the American people, where millions of people vote against you every single election? You start playing to the refs, inventing these boogeymen of voter fraud and ballots being tossed into trash cans and set on fire, and all these other ideas that have no basis in fact or reality. And so if they can present any evidence of it happening, then maybe it will go to court, but many of these cases will simply be dismissed on procedural grounds.
Thank you very much. Let's give a chance to Mr. Logan to respond to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of those allegations did happen as far as ballots being set on fire. That really did happen. And you want to talk about millions voted against the Republican Party. Well, how about we almost had 70 million that voted for the Republican Party? Like I was saying before, let's not ignore these people. Let's have their voices be heard. And it's really unfair to just disenfranchise nearly half of the entire nation that voted simply because, oh, we don't want to look into it. We're Democrats. We just want to ignore it. We want to ignore all the claims, the insider, the whistleblower, the ballots that have been set on fire, ballots that have been discarded. And then there was the curious case of Wisconsin and Michigan, where they found over 100,000 votes overnight. So rather than the vote tally going up at an equal rate for both Biden and Trump, it jumps by like 100,000 votes. How does it really happen? Look into all the questions that are being raised about the election, and then we can get a greater picture. If all the questions are answered properly, and then it comes back, hey, Joe Biden is the victor, Donald Trump lost, then you take it, you accept it, but only until that point and not a second before.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. But I still would like you to clarify something, especially for us people looking at this from outside the U.S. Well, we've been told that it's the electoral votes that count and the popular vote doesn't count, especially 4 years ago in the case of Hillary Clinton, where she won the popular vote, but she didn't win enough electoral votes. When you talk about election fraud, where does this popular vote count and how can it affect the electoral votes, which is actually necessary for any of the candidates to be considered the new president of the U.S.?
Well, the popular vote does matter because in order for a particular state to go towards one president versus the other, they must win the popular vote in that state. So the overall popular vote is kind of misleading. You got to have the popular vote for each state go towards a particular president. And the reason why that system exists is to prevent mob rule, because if not for the Electoral College, then nobody would care about the very small states, West Virginia, Idaho, Iowa, nobody would care. You focus on California, Illinois, New York, maybe Florida, and that's pretty much it, Texas, and then that'll be y'all. And all the states in between would get totally ignored. The system is to have all voices heard, not just some that some people would like to be heard.
Exactly, and especially in this case, well, the Electoral College does realize that there has been some vote rigging, doesn't it? Because they're the ones who have to actually vote for a certain candidate. Won't they realize that there's been fraud in the popular vote, especially in red states, for example, traditionally red states like Georgia? Mr.
Well,
Logan.
I mean, the electors. Oh, go ahead.
Please go ahead, Mr. Logan. Then I'll have Mr. Patillo clear this out for us.
Well, the electors are required to vote for the state that they're that the citizens voted for. Like, okay, they have to vote for Trump. So let's say, for example, Texas. The electors in Texas must vote for Trump because Texas voted for Trump. So there's really no gray area there. I mean, there may be some voter fraud, but that's not in the hands of the electors that would go and vote for Trump from Texas. That goes to the courts and everything else.
So, Mr. Patillo, if you could please clear that out for us, looking at this from outside the U.S.
Okay, I understand. The concept of the Electoral College is a holdover from the Holy Roman Empire, where elector princes would decide on the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire prior to the Napoleonic Wars of the early 19th century in Europe. So it's a concept which is antiquated at its base. The reason that it was implemented in the United States of America was because at the time of the ratification of the Constitution in 1789, there was a concern by the Federalists that you would have states that had large populations dominating the electoral map. This is also why we had the 3/5 compromise, which counted slaves, African Americans at the time, as being 3/5 of a human being for electoral purposes. It was meant to be a buffer so that the ruling class could always maintain the ability to pick leadership and to step away from the wants and desires of the people. That's why America is a republic, not a democracy. So if we want to be an advanced 21st century democracy, these are some of the things that need to go away, because this idea that you are enfranchising Iowa or red states by having electoral college is simply nonsense. That's not what exists currently. What exists currently is a way where in this century, since the year 2000, two of the three presidents did not win the popular vote because we figured out how to manipulate the system. And then whenever Republicans are not able to hold the popular vote or get the majority of the American people on their side for their position, they claim fraud and then never show any proof of fraud. Tell them to show you one instance where voter fraud has swayed an election. Even an election for dog catcher or city janitor or something along those lines is a completely made-up argument that they use to depress the democratic needs of America and other countries. What they've also done is entrench conservatives and Federalist Society cult members into the U.S. judiciary. President Trump's bragged about nominating over 300 judges and now has a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court despite not winning the popular vote in 30 years. So this is the anti-democratic nature of the Republican Party that they're using to push down the desires of the majority of the American people, and they have to come to terms with that. It's not voter fraud the reason you haven't won any elections in the last 30 years. It's not voter fraud for why you're seeing 75 million people at this point vote for Joe Biden and have a 4 to 5 million vote spread over Donald Trump. It's because their policies are unpopular and they're trying to hold up an oligarchical system which is anti-democratic and anti the will of the majority of the American people.
Now, Mr. Patillo, Mr. Logan did point out that the fact that mail-in ballots were counted does open up room for some kind of voter fraud, and he did elaborate on that. Don't you think that this has complicated the situation?
Not at all. 5 states in the United States have used exclusively mail-in voting for over 30 years and never had an instance of in-person or of mail-in voter fraud. There have been no claims, no verifiable claims of any voter fraud as a result of these mail-in elections. President Trump has voted absentee in Florida for the last several years, including his children, Ivanka and Eric. And Eric, it's the exact same thing. You put your vote in the mail and they send it in there. So they made up these boogeymen because they knew 6 months ago, based on polling, they were going to lose this election by millions of votes. So they had to explain make an explanation for that. And that's why even in 2016, when President Trump lost by 3 million votes, he claimed that illegal immigrants and dead people were voting for him and offered no proof in 4 years to verify that. So they made these unsubstantiated claims to justify their oligarchical system, which is meant to depress the democratic needs of the majority of American people, and simply owning up to that and adopting new policies that would be more in line with what the American people want. They continue to play to the ref, make up lies and deceit and fanciful tales about people burning ballots instead of simply saying our policies are unpopular with the American people and we need to change.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. Before I move on to the next question, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to Mr. Patillo on this case.
Okay, well, the whole thing, I think there are plenty of claims of actual voter fraud that are pretty credible and they should be looked into. Just because maybe you don't believe it, maybe you don't think they're actually accurate in your mind, does not mean that it shouldn't get looked into, okay? If there is an allegation made, look into it and see what's going on. If it's false, then it's false. If it's true, then it's true. And you're very good with your words. You're a lawyer, I suppose. I know you are. And you're talking about, well, there's been no actual voter fraud that's swayed an election. I mean, come on. Like, maybe you didn't have 20 million people that had, you know, voter fraud, but maybe there was 100, 200, 1,000, 5,000. We really don't know until we investigate. There's a lot of things, I think, that are happening right now that we'll see in full color once we go through some discovery process, as you would say over there on your side. Once we figure out what's going on, then we can make an assertion. But until then, I think it's kind of irresponsible to say, oh, well, there's no evidence. No, look at the evidence, look at the claims, and then we can figure out what's happening.
Now, moving on to the next topic, Mr. Patillo, we've seen Trump supporters coming out on the streets armed with rifles. What are the prospects, in your opinion, of this election to turn into something violent, basically?
I don't think it's going to turn into anything violent. We saw after President Obama was elected, there were threats on the right wing of violence. We saw after the Tea Party Revolution between 2012 and 2014, the same sorts of credible threats. Even in the 90s, we had the Michigan militia rising up. We had Ruby Ridge. We had Waco. We had far-right cults and separatist organizations that threatened the same thing. Understand that America is not is a very stable democracy. We have our squabbles. We have our same fights. But just as any other domestic squabble or domestic fight, we still come together thereafter. So I think America will recover. We will come back together. We'll understand that our differences are far smaller than what brings us together as a nation. And I think partially is the fact that President Trump came out and gave one of the most disgraceful speeches in American presidential history yesterday. Could you imagine President Ronald Reagan blaming others for why he lost? could you imagine Dwight D. Eisenhower giving that sort of speech that President Trump did yesterday, or Abraham Lincoln, other Republicans, giving a sort of speech where you are blaming and crying and whining and fueling this fire of distrust and hatred in America. So having that sort of demagogue out of office, this is like Alcibiades in Greek history, the Lucius of the Athenians, who used his word to foment war and foment violence and dissension within the ranks. That's not what we do here in America, and I think that's been more so than ever proven by the fact that 3 million people voted against that message last time, and 4 million plus Americans voted against that messaging this time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. Do you believe that it might get violent or not?
No, I don't think so. People on the right generally don't do things like that as far as elections. Okay, if it doesn't go our way, we look at investigation, handling things legally. We don't go towards the streets and riot like the left does. We've seen Portland, Oregon descend into chaos, Los Angeles. We've seen cities all over the nation that have been in pure chaos for the past few months. We don't do that on the right. That's generally a leftist thing, okay? And then as far as, the president had a disgraceful speech, well, let's talk about the past 4 to 5 years, shall we? The whole Russia collusion thing. They were saying, the administration, they were colluding with Vladimir Putin and Ukraine and everybody else, maybe even China, to disrupt the election, to help him win. And then you had, about 3 years, $40 million, 500 subpoenas that yielded a big, fat, nothing burger, zero, zilch, nada, nothing. You had some underlings that got locked up on petty charges for like 5 days in the penitentiary, but nothing came as a result of that as it relates to Trump or any kind of collusion. Same thing with the Ukraine thing. They're talking about, you had a phone call with the Ukrainians talking about he wanted to investigate Joe Biden to help him in the 2020 election. Again, nothing from that. He got impeached, not removed. So it's funny how the left talk about we want a peaceful transition if you don't want to be a banana republic, but they are the very ones that are attempting that in this particular case, from the Russia thing to the Ukraine thing. And then when Ukraine and Russia allegations emerge as it relates to Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, being in business together, all of a sudden, that's a right-wing conspiracy theory, there's QAnon, there's Ruby Ridge, come on. This is really silly. I think the reason why this is like this as far as messaging is because the left control most of the media and also social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. They can control the messaging to make us appear like we're crazy out of our mind. But then when they do what they accuse us of doing, then it's okay. Then it's, quote unquote, protecting their democracy. It's ridiculous.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. I'm very sorry to cut you off. We're running out of time. We have less than 2 minutes, and this final question is really crucial to wrap this up. Can the next president of the United States bridge the gap in this clearly polarized society? Mr. Logan.
Well, I don't know what Joe Biden can do or what Trump can do. I think it's all about the American people. What are we going to do? I think if you have somebody in there that's going to be inflammatory as far as saying, cops are killing people and whatnot, that's not really going to make it go in the proper direction. If you have a guy in there that says, let's come together, make the country better, I think that'll do wonders. It all depends on what each president's messaging is.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Petillo.
Let's understand, one, on that idea that Republicans are not rioting in the streets, let's understand Heather Heyer in Charlottesville is dead because of a right-wing militia. Kyle Rittenhour killed two people in Kenosha, Wisconsin with an assault rifle, and they let him go home. These are the types of right-wing lunatics that we're talking about. And on this idea of bringing the nation together, President Trump has had 4 years to bring the nation together. And with that disgraceful speech that he did last night, he has shown he has no ability to bring together the other 52% of Americans who disagree with him. Joe Biden, the president-elect right now, is the only person currently in power who has the ability to bridge that gap and heal the nation that we've needed for so many years.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robert Petillo, Democratic strategist, and Anthony Brian Logan, conservative political commentator. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for being on this show and elaborating on these different issues, and thanks for following this edition of The Debate.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question that often pops up in the minds of people, and that's the relationship between the nature of the relationship between God's essence and His attributes. Sometimes it's asked, what is this relationship? Are the different names and attributes which have been ascribed to God, are they one with His essence? In which case, it would lead to God being composed of parts and being a composition, which contradicts His simplicity. Are they extraneous to His essence? In which case, it would mean that God would be dependent on things other than Him in order to possess these properties, which would in turn lead to a multiplicity in divinity, and it would contradict His simplicity. Or is God the representative of these parts in the sense that He doesn't have these attributes? Rather, He performs the actions that a being with these attributes would perform. Or are all of these attributes conceptually distinct from one another, but they possess one instance in the external world, which is also impossible in the sense that it would lead to a contradiction. It would lead to one thing being a multiplicity of things, which is also wrong and impossible. How do we resolve this problem? How do we resolve this paradox? And also, what is the view of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet, regarding this? The answer to this question is that the truth is that it is the final alternative and possibility which is correct. In other words, we are of the opinion that these attributes, these names, they are conceptually distinct from one another, but they share one instance in the external world. The problem that this person mentioned, in other words, that this would lead to a contradiction, it would lead to one thing being a multiplicity of things, it doesn't arise. It doesn't arise. Why? We can answer this problem and show how this doesn't arise in two ways. First of all, we can answer this by way of an example. Let's take one of God's creatures into consideration. This creature is one thing, which is both a creature of God, it is something known by God, it is something created by God, it's something that God has power over. Many different attributes are ascribed to it. We may ask the following question. Are these two properties, being created by God and being known by God, are they properties which are extraneous to the essence of this creature, or are they internal to it? It's obvious that they're internal to it, they're essential to it. You can't say that the essence of this thing is not created by God or not known by God. That's wrong. Nor can we say that these properties are internal to the essence of this being, but are parts of the being. This would imply that from one point of view, this thing was created by God, but from that point of view, it's not known by God. Or from one point of view, it's known by God, but from that point of view, it's not created by God. This is wrong. God is absolute in His act of creation. Everything is created by Him, and His knowledge is absolute. He knows everything from every point of view. So we have to say that from the very point of view that it's created by God, and it's a makhluk for God, it's known by God, and it's ma'lum, it's known by Him. In essence, this answer emphasizes the objection this person mentioned, in the sense that this also leads to a contradiction. It would mean that one thing from one point of view is two things, which is impossible. Well, the answer and resolution to this question is that in order for two propositions to contradict one another, it's necessary for all of the clauses and conditions of the two propositions to be the same. In the case at hand, this is not true. How this is not true is something we'll examine in some of our forthcoming discussions. Until then, I'm Shiraz Agha. We were talking about the relationship between God's essence and his attributes on The Key. Thank you for joining us here today. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB.